Welcome to the Relocate Global and Think Global People podcast series on emerging trends in leadership. I'm absolutely delighted to have with me today Dr. Susan Shortland, who's going to enlighten us on some of the approaches and solutions that are available to leaders and global mobility professionals in this sphere. I'm your host, Marianne Kerfey. I'm a writer for Relocate Global and Think Global People, and I write about finance, technology, workplace culture, and diversity and inclusion. Sue is a senior lecturer in human resources management at the University of Westminster. Her career spans more than 40 years, during which time she's worked in both the private and the public sectors. She's a chartered fellow of the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development and a senior fellow of the Higher Education Academy. Prior to working in higher education, Sue worked in a managerial role in international human resources management consultancy, KPMG. Prior to this, she managed the CBI's Employee Relocation Council. Welcome, Sue.
Hi, Marianne.
So today, we're going to address leadership and the challenges that leaders and managers face in talent and career management. Talent has lots of different meanings in different contexts. Although we use the phrases such as the search for talent or the shortage of global talent, the concept can mean different things to different people and organisations. Also, talent management sometimes viewed just from the employer's perspective, thinking about maximising productivity and profit and managing people in that concept. But actually, employees themselves want to develop their own potential and talent, and they often look to the employer to support their personal and professional progress and growth. So Sue's here to help unpick some of these complex issues and to give some suggestions as to how organisations might be able to move forward. So Sue, we regularly hear the phrases the search for global talent, but what does talent actually mean and why is it not a neutral or a degree definition?
Well, it's highly subjective because, as you say, talent means different things to different people, but it's generally thought to refer to those who can make a positive difference to organisational success. So what that's really saying is that talented people can deliver a greater contribution than those who perhaps do not have talent. But of course, you can also say, well, what about latent talent? People can develop talent. They can develop the desired competencies that will lead to organisational success. So therefore, you've got sort of two definitions. You've got actual talent that's in the here and now and potential talent that can be developed for the future. So that's why it's not really an agreed definition as to exactly what we mean by talent.
I think also the identification of talent depends on the organisation, doesn't it? Because an organisation that's moving a lot of people around the globe needs agile assignees who are willing to take on different assignments, often in fairly challenging environments, whereas a tech company would have a different idea of what talent meant. So how is talent linked to an organisation's strategic goals?
Well, what you need in the way of talent is going to vary according to sort of different economic situations, for example, different legal contexts, different political environments. All of those impact on how you define talent and what you're actually looking for. So really what you're looking for is you're looking for the ability for people to display competencies. And competencies, that's another term that's bandied around a lot and, you know, often is not well defined. But typically what it refers to is it refers to the skills that people can bring. It's the knowledge that they can bring, but it's also their behaviours. So it's how people will actually adapt their skills and their knowledge to operate successfully in different contextual environments. So particularly in a global sphere, when you're moving people around the world, for example, and they're moving across different economic, legal, political environments, but borders and so on, it does actually mean that they have to be able to adapt their competencies to suit where they are being deployed.
So why is this something that organisations need to address? Why is it not just something that employees should upskill themselves?
Well, obviously, whatever the desired competencies are, they've got to match organizational strategic objectives and goals. So while employees will want to develop their own capabilities, their own competencies, they'll want to increase their skills base, they'll want to increase their knowledge base, and they'll need more sort of experience working internationally to gain behavioral competencies that work in different environments. They can do that, but they've got to match that to what employers actually need. So it's a two-way street. It's great to have, you know, very capable employees who are willing to learn and willing to adapt. But what they do learn and what they, you know, their behavioural competencies have got to match to what employers actually want in the environment that they're operating in.
That's a really interesting point, because there's a kind of two-way pull here, isn't there? Employers might think of their talent pool as a group of people who can be deployed in different places to sort of maximize efficiency and help them meet strategic goals. But these are individuals, and they've also got their own personal and professional goals. And I wondered why the management of employee careers is really critical, and why sometimes organizations don't always take that into account when they're thinking about moving people around.
Well, it's probably because they've got their eye on the strategic goals. So they know what they want for organizational success. And they know, for example, what their shareholders are looking for in terms of return on investment and, you know, productivity and so on and so forth. But if you just keep your eye on the strategic side, but you don't take into account the human resource management side, i.e. the people, then you might not necessarily be giving people the opportunities that they feel they want or that they deserve. So it's important to think about it from an employee perspective as well, because you need them to be motivated, you need them to be engaged, and you need them to, you know, want to go the extra mile for that organizational success. So it is about engaging employees, because, you know, you can give employees developmental opportunities, they increase their skills, their knowledge, their competencies, and then they go off and work for somebody else. Well, you really don't want that, do you? Because that's an expensive talent development strategy, because you'll develop them and off they go. So the idea is, if you can keep them engaged and keep them aligned with your organizational objectives, such that they actually want to achieve them and meet them, and they can see a role in that, then that becomes a win-win situation. The employees become more developed. When they want to move on, they've got more skills and competencies. But while you have invested in them, they're prepared to give back to you and go the extra mile for your organizational success.
So is that what's meant by the term the psychological contract, or is that something different?
The psychological contract is certainly links to this, because what it's about is a contract of reciprocal expectations. So everybody has an economic contract. That's, you know, a legal document. It's written down. You know what your pay and conditions are.
Salary, yes.
Yeah. So you know that. But the psychological contract is about your expectation of your employer. So it's not necessarily written down that you're going to get developmental opportunities or international experience. But if you work hard and you perform well, and, you know, everything you do is good, you kind of expect something back in return as an employee. So the psychological contract is this idea of reciprocity. You'll do something for your employer if your employer does something for you. You sort of expect something back. And it doesn't have to be money. It doesn't have to be reward. But it can be issues like, you know, developmental opportunities, career growth, and so on. You know, it's about really employees' present contributions being balanced against, you know, future benefits that they expect to receive. And they just trust their employers that they will provide it. And of course, the problem is if that psychological contract is damaged or broken, then it's a bit of a turn off for employees, really. It's very negative. Yeah. You know, I've done all this work, I expect something back. And if you don't get it, you tend to feel quite disillusioned and potentially might leave your firm.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the way you've described it, actually, I can see how it makes perfect sense. But then if the employee doesn't articulate to the employer what they're expecting, or if the employer doesn't communicate what is available for the employee to use to develop and build up these skills, then there might be a mismatch between what the employee is expecting and what the employer thinks that they're doing. Maybe they think they're doing a great job and the employee feels neglected. So
yes,
I agree. Is it about communication on both sides, or is it about employers really being clear about what you can expect when you join the firm and how your career can progress?
It's not just when you join, it's obviously as you're going through your career, isn't it? But I do take your point that communication is a really good thing. But no matter how much communication is in place, people's expectations will always differ from what is communicated, in the sense that they might still expect something else. So, you know, the employer says, well, we're going to offer international experience for your career growth. But that doesn't necessarily articulate exactly what kind of experience, where is it going to be, what's the assignment like, so on and so forth. Is it even physical mobility, or is it sort of, you know, more remote type working? So our thoughts, we're all human beings, and our thoughts, we don't always articulate our own thoughts. We don't always make them clear ourselves. And so the communication can be good, and the better it is, obviously, the better in terms of pleasing employees and getting them to be more productive. But we don't always express everything. And that's the problem. The psychological contract will always be there. And it covers the gaps that aren't actually articulated so precisely.
Yeah, I can see that that might sometimes be problematic. What are the different approaches for home-based, host-based and global assignments?
Employers do have options here in terms of deploying talent and deciding how they want to fill vacancies. So, you know, one option is to you send people from your home country or your headquarters country. So those are typically international assignees. And the advantages is that they take with them the home country organizational culture. They're like culture carriers, and they can take the message and the strategy across. The drawback is, of course, is that top jobs tend to then be filled by people from headquarters, and local people feel a bit disillusioned because they can't see how they're going to get those top positions. The alternative is the opposite, really, is you deploy talent from the host location. So it's local people get to fill the top jobs. And that's really good for motivating local people. They can see career progression. But the drawback is you don't necessarily see the global vision because you're at a local level. And also the culture could start to drift away from the home country or headquarters culture to a much more local approach. And then your third one is the global or regional approach, where you move people around talent from a wider talent pool, obviously, if you're drawing upon regional or global mobility. But again, here these are typically international assignees. And certainly when you're looking at global deployment, you've got lots of sort of compliance issues, particularly moving people around the world, like visas and tax implications and so on. So there's lots of options for talent. There's no perfect solution. And generally, organisations use a mixed approach to get the best talent that they need in the locations where they're operating.
And in terms of giving opportunities to all the employees, that's something that would be important in the psychological contract. But often decisions to develop and appoint employees can sometimes be gender-based, can't they? So I'm wondering whether leadership, because leadership is gendered, does that affect decisions on appointing talented women in senior and international roles? I mean, we know how important it is for international experience, for career development. So if women are missing out on this, you know, does this mean that their careers potentially are not progressing perhaps as fast as they should?
Yeah, there's a lot of issues to unpick in this, in the sense that depending on who's making the selection decisions. So if you're looking for sort of filling leadership positions, quite often the selection decisions are made by people in very senior positions. And often those are men. So they tend to select people. What we all do is, you know, you're selecting your own image, really. So the issue there is you're more likely potentially to appoint men than women. There's also the talent pool. So there's lots of talented women out there, but they may or may not be high enough up in the hierarchy. The glass ceiling is known to apply to sort of women's career progression. So obviously there are problems with this, but typically I think employers do want to see greater diversity in senior leadership roles, and they are attempting to make more of these roles available to women. But women's careers are also quite sort of disjointed compared with men's, not always, but, you know, many women will take some time out for raising a family. And as a result, that actually can affect their career progression as well. So there's lots of issues to unpick in that, but certainly employers are definitely trying to improve representation of women in senior roles, which is good to see, because women have, you know, a lot of talent and they actually have different competencies to men, and are particularly well known in the international world, for international assignments and so on, of actually conducting these extremely well. They're very successful at doing them. So definitely it's an advantage for employers to have more women assignees at senior levels.
So from the employer point of view, it's important to identify those women who might be suitable for an international role, but there's also sometimes a culture in organisations where women don't put themselves forward or don't even think that or consider themselves suitable candidates because of issues around family or career or competency. So what can employers do to support women who are coming through in sort of lower and middle management roles to help them understand how they can upskill or how they can improve their own career in terms of putting themselves forward for roles that they might not have done?
I think this is where the role of sort of mentors, sponsors, and role models comes in, and also networks that help women to identify roles that are available. Because quite often roles are not necessarily openly advertised, so you find out about them through networking, and women tend to have fewer networks than men. So, ensuring that women take part in networking activities is helpful. Mentors and sponsors, I mentioned, mentors act as kind of guides and coaches, really, but sponsors take responsibility. So they're held accountable. So in a way, having a sponsor that ensures that women are taken into account in selection decision making is important. And then role models, of course, if women see others at senior levels able to manage these roles and do well in them, they're more likely to think, well, yes, I can do this too. So these kind of interventions are particularly helpful for women to gain leadership opportunities within organisations.
Yeah, so in terms of visibility, seeing other women who are performing the roles that you might aspire to as a female.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I get the feeling sometimes in assignments, a vacancy happens and it has to be filled quickly. And, things take longer than they should, perhaps because of border controls and visas and sorting out families and supporting cultural training. So I'm wondering why it's important for organisations to plan ahead so that they don't have these kind of gaps or problems in the talent pipeline, and what they can do in terms of strategy to make sure that they're not suddenly caught without somebody at senior level who they need to move to another country.
Yeah, I mean, having a sort of career paths and succession planning in place is obviously a positive thing because, as you say, it helps you plan ahead. And the idea is, and certainly in large companies, they do tend to do this, is what they'll do is they'll like map out individuals' careers. And in a way, that's quite good for employees, too, because they can see what's coming up, what's likely to, be offered to them in the future. So that actually helps with issues like managing the psychological contract, for example. But in terms of doing this, I mean, it's extra work in a sense. You've got to actually have the tracking in place. You need to know where people are, what they're doing, what competencies they're developing, and then work out how you're going to develop whatever they need to move across into the next role. So it's got to tie in with training and development interventions as well. But the idea really is if you've planned career paths, you're tracking your talent, you've got succession planning in place, that actually negates this, hasty decision making and problems of filling vacancies that you've just mentioned. So yes, that's important. But you need the sort of IT systems in place to support you with this as well, I think.
Yes, I think you've said previously that actually it's about measuring and reviewing. And if things aren't measured, then they don't get done. And also, if you're not measuring them, you don't know where things are going and you can't keep track of who's developing what skills in what role. So yes, a good point there.
Yeah, I think performance reviews and development reviews are helpful here as well, because the performance review is going to actually track the performance. So it's going to determine, you know, have people met their objectives and what sort of training and development they might need going forward. And then development reviews give the opportunity to see how well that development is matching what you want these employees to do. Mm-hmm. And they also gives employees the opportunity to speak up and say, well, yeah, I'm interested in this now, or I can't do it right now because I've got this family issue or whatever it might be, but I'm still interested in the future. So that helps you, because it means that you can't have this sort of clinical database that says X person is going to go to Y location on Z date, because, you know, if something happens in that person's family life and they can't move at that time, you do need to have sort of backup plans, and you do need to keep a track of what's going on such that personal circumstances can be accommodated where necessary.
So building some flexibility into those systems as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So can we talk a little bit about the different options that organisations have and how they can manage and develop talent globally?
Well, there's a range of things. I mean, we've talked primarily so far about sort of organisationally initiated assignments. So it's where the organisation determines that they want someone to fill an international vacancy and you know, sends people abroad. But there are other options as well. So individuals can volunteer, so self-initiated mobility, for example. If you don't want to move home, then another option potentially might be some sort of international business travel or sort of frequent flyer style of mobility to be able to gain international experience that way. But you don't even physically have to do that. I mean, there's options for sort of international networks and sort of action learning sets and project work and so on that can take place where you remain in your home country, but you work as part of a global team and you gain international experience that way without necessarily having to leave the country or move home or whatever that might involve. Coaching and mentoring globally is an example of helping people to develop competencies without necessarily physically having to relocate themselves and their families. So those are some ideas. And then your graduate training programs or middle management leadership development programs, where you move people abroad for short periods, a series of, for example, 6-month assignments, to gain experience in different environments. That's another method that companies might consider using as well.
So in conclusion, thinking about the contract between the employer and the employee, thinking ahead to identify talent that's going to meet future business needs, introducing management and leadership training, coaching and mentoring, perhaps particularly for women, helping them understand how to use networks and put themselves forward for assignments, enabling individuals to see their own potential and their potential for the firm. These are all really helpful and kind of solid things that organisations can do. Any sort of final thoughts on managing and developing talent globally?
I just think I'd pick out the point about sponsorship. It's about accountability. So it's all very well offering these interventions, but having somebody who takes accountability for them, responsibility for them, and who's actually performance managed on what they do to support individuals to, gain access to these programs, for example, I think that's an important thing. So I go back to the sort of monitoring and evaluation and the accountability factors, I think, are very important if you want your global talent and sort of career management systems to actually work in practice.
Thank you, Sue. Lots of great information and tips there for organisations, and a really great deep dive into managing talent globally. Thank you so much for your time. This is one of a series of podcasts on leadership and global mobility. Do check out our others on diversity and culture. And we hope to see you again soon for another of our leadership podcasts for Think Global People.